one senator that we're still missing. They can't seem to locate her. We'll go ahead and start the hearings. This is a special committee from the Resources Committee to take testimony and to get a presentation from the federal sector and then from the state sector on the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, known as ANWR. Purposes of the hearing are to disseminate as much as possible the subjects and the positions of the federal agencies, the state agencies, and the private sector as to the opening up and the development of the ANWR area of Alaska. We have before our committee four legislative actions. We have Senate Joint Resolution Number 7, Senate Joint Resolution Number 17, Senate Resolution 12, and Senate Resolution 13. Senate Resolution 7 is the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge Oil and Gas. Senate Joint Resolution 17 is the Federal Conservation Units in the state. Senate Resolution 12 is the Canadian Oil Development in the Arctic. And Senate Resolution 13 is ANWR Porcupine Caribou Herd Management. And those are the issues that are before the committee. The purpose, of course, is we hope that the four committee hearings that we will be having throughout the state next weekend, we will be in Anchorage on Friday and Saturday at the Lusac Library. Following week, we'll be in Ketchikan. That's Friday the 20th and the 21st at the Ketchikan Community College. And then on the last weekend in March, we'll be in Kodiak. And the purpose of having these hearings is to disseminate as much as possible into the public sector or the private sector the issue of ANWR, because it's a big issue as far as the state of Alaska is concerned. Let the record show that we have present Senator Arlis Tirchaluski and Senator Jim Duncan, Senator Lloyd Jones, myself, Senator Coghill, as chairman, and we also have with us, representing the Senate Special Committee on Oil and Gas, Senator Betty Fahrenkamp. She'll be sitting here. She stepped out for a moment. What we would like to do, first of all, is to start the hearings by having the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service give a presentation, 30 minutes or more. What we'd like to do then is to have questions by the committee to clarify their position. Then we'd like to go to the U.S. Geological Survey and have a presentation by them, and then questions by the committee. There was suggested that maybe we ought to, and then we'll go to U.S. Bureau of Land Management. We'll have them give a presentation and then have questions. It was suggested that maybe all three presentations, but I think that in order to be able to clarify the issues for our committee members, why they would like to be able to ask questions as we go along. It's more to get the clarification. Then this afternoon, we'll recess around noon for lunch, and then we'll come back in at 1:30, and we'll start the process going, and we'll have the Office of the Governor will give a statement, and then we'll have the Department of Fish and Game, Department of Natural Resources, and Department of Environmental Conservation will give a overview in that order, and we'll do it the same way, 30-minute presentation, question and answers. Tomorrow, on Saturday, it is our intent to have start at 9 o'clock, and we'll have a different van so that we'll be here and be on time. We'll reconvene, and we're going to have requested witnesses. Most of those will be people from the private sector or from the industry sector. And we'll start our public comments at 11 o'clock, and we'll go until 3 or until such time as we need to. So with that, if there forward to the table, all three, two, or whatever, and start your presentation.
Copy of the final report in committee.
which I will submit to the committee for the record. We can provide additional copies of the report if the committee so desires. During the same period of time that the baseline wild fish and wildlife studies were being conducted, the Bureau of Land Management, U.S. Geological Survey, and exploration crews from private industry conducted surface geological studies aimed at assessing the oil and gas potential. Fish and Wildlife Service participated in these studies by developing stipulations aimed at minimizing or avoiding the environmental impacts, provided special use permits which allowed the activities to occur, and monitored the progress and the effects of the activities. We will have further discussion about particularly focused on the oil and gas resources from the representatives of the USGS and BLM, so I essentially will not address that topic. I would, however, like to go on and just try to give a brief overview of some of the wildlife values of the refuge. I'm going to focus on the major wildlife species. And the first one that's shown here relates to the caribou herd that use the refuge. And what we have shown is on the bottom, one of the major wintering areas of the porcupine caribou. And up at the top, calving areas, summer range, and insect relief habitat. And Glenn has indicated with his pointer just where those are. We can go on to the next one, Glenn. I think perhaps some of the committee members have seen these charts before, and I hope it won't be boring for you, but perhaps some of the other members here have not. This, again, deals with the porcupine caribou, and what it does is show the major paths of movement between wintering areas and summering areas, or the calving areas. And you may not be able to see it clearly, but that shows that the wintering habitat of the porcupine caribou crosses the border between Alaska and the Yukon Territory, so that this is an international resource. We have both Canada and the United States share it. It's in Canada at certain times of the year and in the United States at other times of the year. Particularly important for on the U.S. habitat is that it forms the major calving grounds of the caribou, shown in green up there. The next chart shows range and locations of doll sheep habitat and of moose habitat. This area comprises the furthest north area for doll sheep. On the other side of that chart, the area shown in red indicates the most valuable moose habitat. There is not highly valuable, high densities of moose on the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. The chart on the left indicates areas that are important for polar bears. We do have polar bears denning on land on the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge and in the 1002 area. And the offshore areas are also very important. The map on the other side, on the right, shows the ranges of muskox. Muskox were introduced as a refuge a number of years ago and have expanded considerably to somewhere between 450 and 500 animals now. Most of their habitat the better habitat is concentrated on the river valleys in the 1002 area. Okay, the last one shows the major waterfowl habitat. Fall concentration areas are shown in purple, and the summer areas, summer molting areas are shown in red, a narrow strip along the coast. The final one indicates the critical fish habitat on the refuge. Fish habitat is limited by the availability of water that will permit the fish to live over winter. Much of the water on the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge freezes. The permanent water areas that are there are relatively shallow for the most part, and often freeze to the bottom. Even in the rivers, essentially discussing. An interagency working group was established, made up from members of the Fish and Wildlife Service, the Bureau of Land Management, the U.S. Geological Survey. We had additional counsel provided by the Solicitor's Office, and environmental guidance came from the Office of Environmental Project Review in the Department of Interior. It was a responsibility of this group to determine the format of the report, collect materials, edit, and be responsible for printing of the report. The original intent was to follow the process of doing a legislative EIS. And a legislative EIS differs from a regular EIS in the public review and comments is ordinarily deferred until after the document goes forward to Congress. In this case, however, and because of the great public interest, the decision to do a legislative EIS and withhold it from public review until it was submitted to Congress was challenged in court. The court decision ruled that it should be made public and comments received before it was submitted to Congress, and that's the course that the Fish and Wildlife Service has followed. At this point, the comment period has closed. Something over 11,000 comments have been received, and they're in the process of being analyzed now and the report revised. The team is actively working on the revision as we meet today. I'd like now to briefly mention some of the major points of the major sections of the report. The executive summary, I think, is the most useful part of this for a quick overview of what the report contains and what the results are. Chapter 1 explains the reason the report was written and how the process was set up to write it. The existing environment of the Gen 02 area is discussed in Chapter 2. The oil and gas potential is discussed in Chapter 3. Chapter 4 contains the scenarios used in making the analyses of oil and gas potential. Chapter 5 describes the alternatives that were considered, ranging from no action to full leasing, including a wilderness designation. Chapter 6 discusses the environmental consequences, and this is perhaps one of the most important chapters in the report. It occupies approximately a third of the total quantity of the report. Chapter 7 is an economic analysis relating to the importance of the potential oil and gas resources on the refuge to national security. And finally, Chapter 8 is a recommendation of the Secretary of the Congress. I try to summarize again quickly. I try to give you a brief encapsulation the department's analysis of the geological studies and surveys indicate that the 1002 area is clearly the most outstanding oil and gas frontier remaining in the United States and could contribute substantially to domestic energy supply. The oil resources are most likely to be found in some 26 subsurface structures that were identified during the course of the seismic and other studies. Each one represents an opportunity for a significant oil discovery. Other areas within the coastal plain also have some potential for containing hydrocarbon resources. The range of options that I mentioned earlier consists of 1, leasing the entire coastal plain, or 2, leasing only certain portions of the coastal plain, or if it was decided that more detailed information be needed. A third option then would be to conduct an exploration program that would provide that kind of information before Congress made a decision. The fourth would be to take no action at this time and essentially leave the refuge in 1002 area as it is. It would be managed as an integral part of the refuge under a comprehensive conservation plan that is now in the process of being developed. And finally, the fifth alternative would be to designate the entire area as an addition to the wilderness that has already been designated by the Congress, and essentially the shaded area, which defines the approximate boundaries of the original Arctic National Wildlife Range, is now the designated wilderness area on that refuge that was designated by Congress at the time of calving, important calving grounds for the porcupine caribou would be afforded some special protection in this area by having development occur in outside of that area, leaving that to be the last area to be developed. That is one of the options that the Secretary could select here. Section 1002 also required that an assessment of the potential environmental consequences if oil and gas development did occur on the 1002 area. The assessment has predicted that environmental consequences of developing the entire 1002 area would be some long-term effects on the area's water resources, on caribou from the porcupine herd, and on muskox. The presence of structures are of the necessary structures required to support oil and gas development, including a pipeline to transport the oil to the Prudhoe Bay area, where it could be entered into the Trans-Alaska pipeline system, would eliminate the wilderness characteristics of the 1002 area for all practical purposes. Most adverse effects, it is believed, could be minimized or eliminated through carefully applied mitigation and using lessons learned and technology acquired from developments that have occurred elsewhere, including in the Prudhoe Bay area and from the construction of the Trans-Alaska pipeline system. The evidence generated during 18 years of exploration and development of Prudhoe Bay suggests or indicates that minimal impact on wildlife resources could be expected. It is reasonable to assume that development can proceed on the coastal plain and generate similar minimal effects. I'd like to take, in closing my presentation, take a few minutes to talk a little bit about some of the more detail on the environmental consequences. The potential effects of each of the alternatives have been assessed in the report. And to summarize these, the last two alternatives, which would be a wilderness designation or a no further congressional action designation, which is concluded would result in no adverse effects on fish and wildlife resources. However, those two alternatives would preclude further exploration to determine what the oil and gas potential of the area was. Short-term activities associated with additional exploration of the 1002 area would lead to some short-term displacement and disturbance of fish and wildlife resources, and probably would have some short-term effects on the subsistence uses of the area. It is believed there would be little or no residual long-term effect on wildlife populations. Wilderness attributes of the area would be affected, however. Long-term losses in fish and wildlife resources, subsistence uses, and wilderness values would be the inevitable consequences of a long-term commitment to oil and gas development, production, and transportation. If producing fields were discovered, it is estimated that petroleum operations would last from between 30 to 90 years. Oil and gas discovery would lead to industrial development. There will be pressure to use this area as a base to service exploration and development on the Outer Continental Shelf, or to intertie with projected oil and gas development in the Canadian Arctic. An oil development infrastructure in the 1002 area would be an impetus to develop state lands between the Canning River and the Trans-Alaska pipeline system. The infrastructure in the 1002 area would serve potential offshore or other fields, adding to the long-term industrial commitment and setting the stage for long-term environmental impacts. Oil and gas development would result in widespread changes in wildlife habitats, wilderness environment, and native community activities. They could include displacement and reduction in the size of the porcupine caribou herd, which would have an impact not only in the United States, but in Canada as well. The amount of the reduction and its long-term significance for herd viability is a matter of speculation right now, because there's many things that we do not know still about how caribou respond to some of these activities and over the long term, and how this ultimately affects the total herd ecology. Geography does apparently limit the availability of suitable alternative calving or insect relief habitats for the porcupine caribou herd. Mitigation measures can minimize some of the adverse impacts to the porcupine caribou establish whether other wildlife species wellness characteristics and subsistence uses in these mitigation activities would be utilized to the maximum extent possible. Industrial development could profoundly affect native culture. Although it may provide jobs for villages like Kaktovik, it will hasten changes from a lifestyle based on subsistence and community sharing and a dependence on the land to a society with a cash-based economy. Increased education, employment, health services would be positive. Basically, that is an overview of the kind of information contained in the report. And I'm not sure what your pleasure is, Mr. Coghill, Senator Coghill, but I would suggest that John Doble could now discuss the interrelationships between this and the land exchange that's been under consideration now.
Before we go into that, maybe if there's any questions of Senator Sturgis.
Chairman, if we could, just on a few points, in the final recommendation of the leasing, is that for exploratory only or exploration and development? What are we talking about?
I think we're talking about all three.
Well,
initially, that would be additional exploration.
That would be the first phase, then, and further action by Congress, is that the Secretary's recommendation? Do you know? Would it take further action to move from the exploration to the development stage?
I think Congress would have the option of phasing this in any way it would like to, but I believe the recommendation is for Congress to open the area up not only to exploration, but to development and production.
I'm interested on the, obviously the caribou is going to be the big one. Was the Val Cameron caribou study the major input that you had on making the recommendations? I know that study dealt with the road system, and there was a great deal of extrapolation of data, that it seems to me. And I wonder if, you know, where did the data on the impact on the caribou come from?
I know that was an important part of it, but if I may, I'd like to ask Mr. Ellison. Senator Sturgis-Luzke, the Dow Cameron report that you referred to dealing with the effects of the Milne Point Road on caribou was one of many sources used to make conclusions regarding possible effects of oil and gas development in the coastal plain. It was the Dow Cameron report happens to be one of the few pieces of information that provides a quantitative measure of potential impacts. So yes, it was a key piece of data, a key report, but by no means the only one.
So that's a difficult thing. So much hinges on that area, and yet, you know, questions have been raised about use, it becomes all important, and that makes it very difficult, I'm sure, for Congress and others to judge. Most important thing, perhaps. And so just to follow that up, I wonder if you could briefly tell us where the treaty is, the porcupine herd treaty is at this time.
Yes. The present situation is that there have been meetings between U.S. and Canadian officials that most recently in December 1985 and again in six. Those discussions have led to a draft agreement. I guess I would not characterize this as a treaty, but it is a draft of an international agreement between Canada and the United States that would serve to provide a basis for cooperation and coordination in management of the porcupine caribou herd. That has been initialed by the principal negotiators at these meetings and submitted to the two governments for review. It is under review now. Very shortly, we will make that the text of that draft agreement available for public review. And we anticipate that we will be holding public meetings in Alaska in about four locations to provide
likely possibility that, that this would be an agency, an interagency agreement. In other words, it could be signed by the Secretary of the Interior for the U.S. and the Minister of the Environment for Canada. But I'm not sure that that decision has been finally made.
Thank you, Senator. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In your presentation, I noticed that you said the prediction of production. And yet, in the negotiations on the land trade, that the land would be available for 35 years. Is that 35-year period set concrete, or is that still a negotiation period, or do you know, negotiation area?
I would have to defer that question to John Doble, because I'm not directly involved.
I can hold off, John, if you'd like to after your presentation.
That might be more appropriate.
Senator? I have two or three questions, John. Basically, on the caribou bird, two of our specific resolutions deal with the caribou bird, so I have four or five questions on that. What is the scientific basis for the, quote, core calving area that you have? Has that been tracked and studied over a 10-year period, or is there a poor calving area as great or greater in the Mackenzie Delta? How do you track the caribou migration, and how long have you been doing that?
Well, I can't give you specifics on the number of years. I think Mr. Ellison can help us to agree on this, but basically, the core calving area, the so-called core calving area, represents a portion of the most important calving grounds used by the caribou. That is, and I believe that's defined as something like 50 animals per square mile. That is, in which that entity of use has occurred most frequently over a period of years. But let me ask Ms. Bell to expand on that to be sure that.
Senator Coghill, the calving distribution for the porcupine herd has been mapped now for, I believe, 15 years, starting back during the Arctic gas studies in the early 70s. A variety of investigators have worked on it, the Canadian Wildlife Service, the Yukon Wildlife Branch, a variety of consultants, the Fish and Wildlife Service in the state of Alaska have all been involved. The caribou historically have calved over a very wide range. Core calving area, as the term has been used, is a relatively small portion of that range. It's an area where caribou have historically gone, or have historically calved in much greater density than the peripheral areas. Densities within the core calving area have ranged from a few tens of animals per square mile to over 100 animals per square mile. There is no absolute density that can be attributed to that because it varies from year to year and even within years between areas. But it is an area that where the density is substantially greater than the periphery. Since 1983, we have been able to come up with some indirect measures of density in those areas that we characterize as the core calving area. It's unclear to us, and we don't have the information to make that determination for years prior to that time. But in fact, the density of caribou in these core areas is very, very noticeably greater than it is in the peripheral areas. So they, in fact, can be delineated with some assurance. Now, the process has been over the years. We have mapped these areas, and those areas that have repeatedly been used, the greatest density have been referred to as the core area.
I guess that brings me to, why do the caribou use this particular area as a traditional preferred area over another area that the growth, the floral? Are there other areas which could satisfy if there was a dislocation? Would they move to the east, or would they move to the west, or is there a, in your studies, where the caribou can
acclimatize to the human present and to the present of industry. Have you looked into that? Is that part of your study?
Senator, the answer to your question.
That's about four different questions.
Let me try and take them a piece at a time. The answer is highly speculative, which is one of the things that makes it very controversial. The empirical data simply do not exist to make that determination. It's an absolute certainty. As far as why they go there, there are many possible reasons, or a combination of a reduction in the number of predators, early snow melt, favorable emergence of forage at an earlier time than elsewhere, close association with favorable summer habitat, including insect relief areas. It's difficult to say exactly which one, or if it's a combination of those attributes that make the area important to caribou as a core calving area. Regarding the effect of displacement or alternative habitats, if you will, we simply don't know. Studies to this point have not answered those questions. It's our intent to continue to work on that specific issue because it's, in fact, a key to determining what, if any, impact will occur to the herd. We don't have the empirical information at this time, really, professional judgment.
I guess my concern is that our friends to the east drilled, did their exploration, put the Dempster Highway through that area over the last 10 years, and yet the caribou herd has been increasing. And what is the population of the porcupine herd today as it was when you first started studying it, or when Standard of Alaska went in there? Because that white area that you see in there apparently is where the corridor was going to be when they were talking about the Arctic pipeline. And as I understand it, one of our resolutions deals with it, that there was a tremendous amount of activity by the Canadian government in the Mackenzie area, in the path of the migration of the herd, drilled several wells in that area before they had the treaty, and knowing that it was an impact. In other words, I guess my concern basically is that our friends to the east seem to know what's in there and seem to know what's going, and all of that activity that was in there, the herd increased. Now, can you attribute to what created all of that?
I think both of us might have some light to shed on that question, but one point I'd like to address is that discussions about an international agreement for the porcupine caribou herd go back a long way, and I was involved in some of the discussions that occurred in the late 70s, at which time they actually had it drafted of what was thought at that time would be a treaty. And that was set aside because of the activity that was then, and ILCA was being considered then, and decided it would be best to wait until that was dealt with. But at that time, if my memory serves me correct, it was believed that the herd was somewhere in the vicinity of 120,000, 130,000 animals. Now the most recent counts indicate the size of that herd are about 180,000 animals. So you're correct, over the past decade or decade and a half, the herd has increased. I'm not sure. I'll ask Mr. Ellison to comment particularly on some of the factors that might be involved, but one thing I think we need to keep in mind is that even though the Canadians, there has been some development on the Canadian side of the range, the important calving areas have been relatively free from disturbance, and that's probably a critical factor in the maintenance of that herd and the reproduction of the herd and the gradual increase that has occurred. There was a great deal of concern among some of the Canadian biologists when the Dempster Highway was being constructed that it would have an adverse impact on the herd. To my knowledge, that hasn't happened. It could be that the activities or the disturbance factor not sure that the situations are particularly comparable between Mackenzie and what we might find on the coastal plain of Anwar.
The Canadian side is what you would call the winter range. Yes. They go out of the 1002. They follow along the Arctic coast. They come down into the Mackenzie Basin. They don't get over to the northwest herd, as I understand there. They don't get all the way over into that herd. They follow down the Mackenzie, and then they loop back around and come in by Arctic Village on the south side of that range. Is that pretty much a correct statement?
Generally, yes, Senator. Historically, the herd is wintered in part in Alaska, in part in Canada, with frequently the largest percentage of it being in Canada. One thing I do want to make clear is I did not mean to imply that no calving occurs in Canada. In fact, calving historically has occurred to a certain extent east of the border in the western part of the Yukon, but no major calving to any degree has occurred over in the Mackenzie Delta.
Generally, that chart showed that the range in Canada is generally west and south. Happening on the terrible Dempster Highway, however, it does go through that blue area in the Bulge.
Senator Jones got a question. I'm just wondering, are we talking about a different animal when we're talking about the porcupine herd compared to the Central Arctic herd? Just basically the same type of caribou?
It's the same species, but to a degree. I think each of these herds probably has some characteristics that are more or less unique to it.
Basically the same type of caribou.
Same species, but to a degree, I think each of these herds probably has some characteristics that are more or less unique to it, based on the general ecology of the area where it lives and the different conditions that have been seen out of the one herd, how it grows.
Not suppress the herd. Clearly, that herd has grown substantially in the last decade.
whether all of our studies of these animals, if we understand them anymore, or we just get confused, because it seems to me that you got here the central Arctic herd. I recall the central herd, which was between up in the White Mountains and the central, disappeared.
down your technology, though, Mr. Iger. I imagine that there would be ways that we could do that. We could shut her down for if we have proven to ourselves that that's a danger to the herd, a danger to the calving area, having seen whatever it is that the mechanisms are there, but it doesn't seem to be hurting the central. I guess that's our point. That we need to try and get that. Went on record.
Having talked with BLM and several industry people, I'm not sure that once you go into production, that shutting the field down is really a viable option. Having a problem associated with the field should that happen, I'm not familiar with the details. So it's not the exploration per se that is perceived as a potential problem in the operation. When they go into production. To address the issue of the Central Arctic comparative to the porcupine herd, there are some differences. Obviously, the size of the herd is one. What appears to be the available habitat is another. Density of use of that habitat and migratory conditions are all different. And that's why we're very cautious in making full extrapolations from the Central Arctic herd to the porcupine. So we have taken a very cautious approach to that. I'm not convinced that we can freely extrapolate the results in Central Arctic to the porcupine herd. And quite likely one of the reasons is we simply have some major data gaps. Until those are filled, a lot of these conclusions can be extrapolated on our own. Congress acts in the 102 area, which in fact is part of the refuge, to be brought back into the plan. It's just don't see any effects on the other side. A little bit of information to hand. And I'm unaware of, but there are lots of natural things going on, predation, variations, climate, those sorts of things. Here the effects are not related. As far as unnatural activities or related activities,
I can talk about what necessity that we can get off the land issue. Yes, but it is very important. You know, the impact of, do we have low months up there? Do you that rain? Here you let the nature take a balance.
Sure, you go for the low money for the regulation. Both units 25 and 26 in the direct measure.
And as you study the caribou herd, I guess this is a two-part question. Number one, is the city involved in any of these issues that you're talking about? That's one of our issues on Antwerp. That's doing something. Maybe someplace back in there, someplace that at least are you including the state in it?
Various issues that we've discussed in the state chair. Of course, they take the involved in the development of the draft of the National Agreement on Wildlife Caribou. And if they have involved in discussing the Wildlife Caribou, they're prepared to practice the wildlife caribou. And they plan to describe other activities that have been close to cooperation and coordination with the state. We've worked very closely with the Michigan Department. Providing substantial funding to the state, the Michigan Department, to facilitate their participation in these studies. And we've worked very closely with them now for a number of years, both in the field and then later on in filing the data. The state, in fact, has had the lead in conducting the census work up there, and we have intermeshed hand in glove with them now for several years. In addition, we've worked very closely with our Canadian counterparts. Well, of course, Pine Herd, so it's been a multi-agency intergovernment effort.
All right, let's shift gears a little bit here.
The herd and the adverse effects. And I'm not quite sure. But it impressed me that in the latter ending of the family care, the safer was made in that adverse effects on the Pokemon herd was the subsistence hunting. Would you care to comment on that or am I putting you in the
mind? No, I'm not sure what. Hunting doesn't appear to be one of the things, of course,
on. We talk about that. And even if we're running over, if there's no objection as far as the BLM is concerned, this is important. We're going to have forest and acreage. And next week, you kind of see where we find we get into USGS and the BLM. Why, if we have to go on into the afternoon, why we'll do that too. accomplish before the party is being able to represent to the public whether they desire to proceed with the exchange process. Consequently, the earliest that we anticipate releasing the draft exchange agreement is after the identification of the particular 1002 track that might be proposed for exchange. Then, if the Navy corporations indicate that they wish to continue to pursue the negotiation process, the department will have concrete exchange proposals worthy of public review. At that point, we intend to provide for public review the exchange agreements prior to consideration and signature by the Secretary. I will now be happy to answer any questions you might have to discuss some of the concepts inherent in the contract negotiations.
Let me ask you one question first, and then I'll get to
wildlife. Coastal might be subject to the exchange. We would move forward. sign the agreements or who actually have the agreements ratified.
What is federal and what is state the issue of streams, navigable streams, navigable facility? Is that
fact many, have been reserved since early 1983, and thus were retained in federal ownership under the terms of the Submerged Lands Act, which is incorporated by reference in Section 6M of the Alaska Statehood Act. At no time since January 22, 1943, has any part of the coastal plain been unreserved, and therefore no submerged lands could have passed to the state in statehood. For this reason, we plan to proceed in our exchange negotiations without acknowledging the state submerged lands or the existence of any inland navigable waters in the coastal plain. Both the departments and the state's representative in the exchange negotiations have notified the state corporation of the state's claim. Moreover, if the state corporations are concerned about the state's claims, they have the means simply through the identification process of avoiding those tracks that might be claimed by the state at some point.
Washington during that week, and we were in fact involved.